This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For 40 years, American and Israeli intelligence agencies have had a secret relationship. That relationship is investigated in the new book, Dangerous Liaison. The authors are the award-winning journalists Andrew and Leslie Coburn. They assert that this covert relationship has played a part in such key events as the Suez Crisis, the Six-Day War of 1967, the Gulf War, and the Iran-Contra scandal. According to the Coburns, the U.S. has used Israel as a surrogate in the Third World to carry out actions the U.S. was prohibited from doing itself. One of the current political hot potatoes for Congress is whether to investigate the October surprise, allegations that Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign made a deal with Iran, promising them arms if they delayed the release of the American hostages until after the election. The Coburns say any investigation of the October surprise will lead straight to Tel Aviv.
Well, what we reveal in the book for the first time is an on-the-record statement by a senior Israeli official, General Avraham Tamir, who told us that from the very beginning of the first Reagan administration, Israel was shipping arms to Iran with full cooperation of the United States, that they got a green light from Al Haig, who was then Secretary of State, to go ahead with shipments. This was at the time very much in Israel's interest because they wanted to fill a gap. They'd sold large quantities of arms to the Shah and wanted to resume those arms sales. And for the United States, it was also important, as General Tamir put it to us, because the United States was very concerned with Soviet influence in the region, particularly at the beginning of the Reagan administration. And it was believed in Washington that if they supported Iran, and likewise they also supported through another proxy, Egypt, Iraq, by supporting both sides, they could keep both countries occupied in what turned out to be a rather bloody war and keep the Soviets out. I think that what's very important in looking at what the senior Israeli told us about these early arms shipments of arms from Israel to Iran with full cooperation from the Reagan administration is that this is a totally different picture than what we got from the Iran-Contra hearings. I mean, as everyone remembers, in the Iran-Contra hearings, weapons, we heard in exhaustive detail about how weapons were transshipped through Israel, weapons were taken from Israeli stocks and given to the Khomeini regime. But this was supposedly only in return for promise of getting out hostages, and it was something that supposedly only happened starting in 1985 and 1986, a very limited operation. What the Israelis tell us is that that is not at all the case, and we now have it on the record from a senior official that indeed these kinds of shipments were going on as early as 1981.
So that if the Congress, they really do start an investigation into the October surprise allegation, which, you know, the allegation is that American diplomats held hostage in Tehran in 1980 were held back at the request of the Reagan campaign in exchange for a promise of future arms deliveries. Those arms deliveries were coming from Israel. So if anyone's going to investigate it, they will willy-nilly come across this arrangement with Israel to sell arms to Iran. And so, given the traditional reluctance on the part of the Congress to sort of look into anything Israel might have been involved in, if the Democrats start digging into this in order to get at the Republican administration, they're going to start uncovering some very embarrassing facts about Israel fairly quickly.
It also means that the whole basis for the hearings in 1987, the big, long hearings that we all listen to every day that was known as the Iran-Contra business, that the whole basis of that was simply a lie.
What was the lie?
The lie was that what we were looking at here was weapon shipments that began in 1985, arrangements that began previously in the fall of 1984, and that it was a very limited operation of the U.S. and Israel cooperating to arm Iran with the promise of getting back American hostages.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Andrew and Leslie Coburn, two investigative journalists who have co-authored a new book called Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the Israel-U.S. covert relationship. Now, you date this U.S.-Israeli covert relationship to 1951, when the CIA agreed to accept an offer from Israeli Prime Minister Ben-Gurion to give the CIA access to Israel's connections in the East Bloc and the Soviet Union. What was the nature of this arrangement the way you've researched it?
Well, that's right. The Israelis, the government of Israel at that time, was nervous about what it saw as a lack of support at the highest levels in Washington, particularly from the State Department and the Pentagon. And they wanted to be able to offer something to the Americans, that to make themselves indispensable in some way. The CIA at that time, the Cold War was, you know, at its coldest, was desperate for intelligence about what was going on behind the Iron Curtain in the Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. The Israelis had these networks, you know, because of the very large Jewish population in those regions, had access to a great amount of intelligence information, which was of great interest to the CIA. Also, there were people emigrating from the communist countries to Israel, and they could be debriefed when they arrived in Israel. This was what the Israelis offered the CIA, and which the CIA was very happy to accept. And that was it was from this agreement in May 1951 that we date the what we call the covert relationship between the U.S. and Israel.
So what did Israel want out of that relationship?
Well, Israel really wanted an ally, particularly in Washington, an institutional ally. I mean, their view was that, you know, administrations change, policies change, the State Department policy could change. But if you had an enduring link with an intelligence agency, something that would keep going irrespective of what, you know, the State Department policy might be that particular day, or, you know, what the policy at the top of the Pentagon might be, something that was secret, that was in the background, that went on, something that the Americans wanted, the CIA wanted, then they would have and would keep a powerful ally in Washington. And that is indeed what happened.
Did any money change hands in this relationship?
Later on, it began to. It's certainly a lot of money. In the later 50s, the CIA instituted an operation or a program called KK Mountain, which was involved payments of up to $20 million a year sometimes out of a special, very sort of secret compartment within the CIA funding process, which went to Mossad. And that was to finance or payment to Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, to run operations on behalf of the CIA throughout the Third World and particularly in Africa.
So you're suggesting that Israeli intelligence in some instances became the proxy for the United States and did things that United States would have been prohibited from doing. So it had Israel do it for it. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. The proxy is a good word. In fact, the Israelis have used it themselves. It's not necessarily. Sometimes it's when the U.S. or the CIA was prohibited from doing things, such as, for example, after the Marxist government took power in Angola in 1975, the CIA moved quickly and started an operation to destabilize the new government and to back a rival faction. The Congress found out about this and forbade the CIA to do it. At that point, the Israelis stepped in, were asked to step in, and the Israelis started training the rebels, and the Israelis started giving arms instruction and playing a very, you know, important role in the whole operation. Sometimes it's when, you know, something's just too difficult or embarrassing. For instance, earlier on in Africa, the CIA, although it did work there, had some problems because the Americans were regarded by the newly independent regimes that appeared in the 1960s as sort of neo-colonialists, you know, linked with the old imperial powers of France and Britain. So it was harder for them to penetrate these new states. The Israelis didn't have that problem. They were regarded by the new governments, black African governments in the 1960s, as, you know, former colonials like themselves, and they were welcomed. So the Israelis were better able to penetrate these new countries on behalf of the CIA. So it was a very good example of the kind of ways that Israel's been able to make itself useful to the CIA and over the years.
Did any of your sources tell you things that happened behind the scenes you know, in secret between the United States and Israel during the Gulf War?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is that there were two occasions when Israel wanted to send a force of highly trained commandos to go into western Iraq. The first was before the war. It was in June of 1990. Israel wanted to send the forces in to knock out Saddam's chemical installations. The U.S. put its foot down at the time and said no. There was another very tense moment during the ground war when Israel asked permission to again send commandos into western Iraq, airborne commandos, to knock out the mobile Scud launchers, as one former chief of Israeli military intelligence put it to us during the war in Tel Aviv. We wanted to touch them with our hands. I think that when the White House put its foot down and said, no, you can't do it, we do not want you sending in commandos, they said it very forcefully, and it was a much more tense situation than we've been led to believe.
The example that you're giving where Israel asked the United States for permission to send in troops, in your book you suggest that that Israel has been asking the United States for permission for a lot of things long before the Gulf War.
Absolutely right. And we've come to the conclusions in looking at these different operations that generally that is the case, that Israel doesn't act unless it gets some kind of green light from Washington. Certainly any operation in what they regard as the United States' backyard in Latin America, they would never do anything there without checking it out with Washington. Also, you have cases in Israel's wars where, in 1967, for example, the chief of Mossad had to come to Washington to ask for the green light and come back to Tel Aviv. There was a very important late-night, midnight meeting where he announced that Washington said it would be very happy if they could crush Nasser. And that was terribly important in their decision to act.
Well, to start the Six-Day War, which changed the face, gave us the Middle East we live with today.
If you're just joining us, my guests are journalists Andrew and Leslie Coburn. They've co-authored a new book called Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship. What do you think the state of the relationship now is between the United States and Israel in the light of the peace talks that James Baker has been trying to organize since the end of the war? Shamir has been very reluctant to participate. The negotiations about this are still going on. You're talking about this really tight relationship between the United States and Israel, but that's not what we're seeing in the issue of peace talks.
We're talking about a covert, a secret relationship that's to do with intelligence matters and defense matters, a behind-the-scenes relationship. It's certainly true that, relations between this administration and Israel have appeared to be, cooler than they've been in the past. Nonetheless, the covert relationship continues. That's still there in the background. U.S. aid still flows in, enormous billions of dollars flow as a matter of routine to Israel, despite what rude things politicians might say to each other. And, in fact, the U.S., the negotiations that are being set up, the procedure incorporates a number of many concessions to Israel on this. So I would say that the relationship, although it might seem a little colder than it's been in the past, is hardly over.
Following through on this theory of the covert relationship, if it was as strong a relationship as you're painting it, you think that the United States would be able to pull some secret strings behind the scenes and Israel would just sign up for these peace talks?
Well, Israel appears signed up for these peace talks, so the United States has pulled the string. I think the string was the money that Israel wants. So I would say that everything we see happening indicates that when the United States pulls the string and really means it, when the United States is really interested in achieving something, as they seem to be at the moment, then they get what they want, and the Israelis may huff and puff and create a big, you know, fuss about it and, you know, exercise delaying tactics. But, you know, as it seems now, they're falling into line with what the Americans want.
Andrew and Leslie Coburn co-authored the new book Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship. Coming up, we get a different perspective on that relationship from Benny Morris, an Israeli historian who's just completed a study of his country's intelligence services. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. After I spoke with Andrew and Leslie Coburn about their analysis of the covert relationship between Israel and the United States, we called Israel to speak with historian Benny Morris. He has also researched Israel's intelligence services. He co-authored the new book, Israel's Secret Wars. Like the Coburns, he dates the Israeli-American covert relationship back to 1951. But unlike the Coburns, he doesn't see the relationship as dangerous.
The intelligence services of Western countries, many of them have relationships with the other intelligence services of democratic and non-democratic countries. The Israeli relationship is as legitimate or illegitimate as any other relationship. Obviously, it's secret because that's how intelligence services operate. I don't think it's dangerous. I think that the relationships between the intelligence services of democratic countries usually serve the interests of the democratic countries. And often have enemies who are anti-democratic, and therefore it's good that they share information and other things.
The charges that the Coburns make is that in this particular secret relationship between the United States and Israel, the United States sometimes used Israel as a proxy to do things that the United States wasn't legally allowed to do or practically just couldn't do. Do you have any evidence of that?
Firstly, I haven't read Mr. Coburn's book, so I can't really comment on what it contains. I'm sure that there are covert things which were done jointly. There are probably also covert things done separately, both by the CIA and the Mossad, on the basis of information which the other agency gave it. I'm also sure that favors were done by each side for the other side. I don't know if any of this or all of this was illegal in any way or dangerous to anyone whom it shouldn't be dangerous to.
I'd like to ask you about Israel's arms shipments to Iran. The Coburns say that any congressional investigation of the October surprise will lead straight to Israel and the covert partnership that has existed between Israel and the United States. What do you think?
I don't think anything around the subject because I don't know anything. The only thing I can say is that it doesn't have anything, as far as I know, to do with arms from Israel to Iran. Perhaps the Coburns know something about various Israeli personalities who may have helped various Republicans make connections in Iran. I don't know. But I don't think it has any quid pro quo connection with Israeli arms shipments to Iran, because the timing, as far as I know, is wrong. The initial Israeli shipments, as far as I know, to Iran of spare parts and munitions, which were small scale in any case, as far as I know, began late 81 and 82, and you're talking in terms of what you call the October surprise, you're talking in terms of 1980.
The Israeli arms shipments in question in the Iran-Contra story are arms shipments from the mid-80s, but
so there's two sets. Iran-Contra's from 84-85. That's the second set. The first set is earlier, precedes Iran-Contra, and that, I believe, is 82 we're talking about.
What's the difference in those two series of arms shipments?
One is connected to the American desire to build bridges to the so-called moderates in Iran, and Israeli desires to build bridges to the moderates in Iran, may have been American-initiated, or at least in a larger sense it was American-initiated, even if there were Israeli triggers to it. The first shipments were Israeli-inspired and were basically to send spare parts to Iran to make money and, I think, in part to salvage the Israeli-Iranian relationship and to help Iranian Jews. But they're two distinct. And they were stopped. That is, the shipments of 82 at some point, as far as I remember, under American pressure, were stopped. America desisted from giving its backing to the shipments, as far as I remember, whereas the second set were initiated by America and were stopped for other reasons, not American pressure.
Now, what about the Iran-Contra scandal? Do you think that there's an Israeli connection there?
There was certainly an Israeli connection. Israel was the conduit through which arms were transferred to Iran. The money which was obtained was then in part used to finance the arming of Contras in Nicaragua. I'm not sure how aware Israel was of the use of these funds after they were received from Tehran, but that wasn't the Israeli interest. The Israeli interest wasn't the Contras, even if they knew about it. The Israeli interest was probably largely to help out the American Big Brother, and secondly, to make money. And thirdly, to maintain its geopolitical connection with, as I explained before, with the peripheral great power, non-Arab great power in the area, which is Iran. And to help it, if you like, fight Iraq, which was a persistent Israeli enemy since 1948.
How is it legal for Israel to be the surrogate of the United States in sending arms to Iran?
Well, it's not, as I tried to explain, it's not a surrogate. It's a country conducting its foreign policy with its own interests at heart. If those interests also coincide with those of Washington, then that's all to the good, because Washington is an Israeli ally and Israel wants to help it. But Israeli foreign policy required a strong link as possible with Iran, and included sales of arms to Iran. And if money could be made out of it, so much the better. And if Iranian Jews could be protected by it, so much the better. There's nothing illegal about Israel selling arms. Perhaps one day, when Israel is in a safer position in the world and can start and richer and can start selecting who to sell arms to and who not to, and sets up laws about who this should, you know, regulating this sort of these arms sales, its own arms sales, then perhaps there'll be room for investigation if something happens which is contrary to law. But at the moment, Israeli arms sales, which are incidentally extremely secret, the whole business is very secret, not like in America, is in the hands of the government, and then it conducts policy as it sees fit.
Binny Morris co-authored the new book, Israel's Secret Wars, A History of Israel's Intelligence Services. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.